This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Richard Reed. I'm the senior curator on the Irish exhibition that we've got downstairs. And, of course, this series of family history lectures is being run in conjunction with the Irish exhibition. Now, I suppose I have to ask the question, who has not been to see the Irish exhibition? You don't have to put your hand up. That's all right. I would hope during these series of lectures, if you're coming to the others, that you would take the opportunity to do it, because I think it's very important if you're doing Irish family history, and I assume that a lot of you are interested in that particular thing, and we'll come back to some of the other lectures as well. The exhibition we've got will put the family in context of the 19th and 20th century within Australia. So I do think it's important for you in relation to your family history studies to get a sense of that wider history inside which the family is embedded. Okay, well, that's my bit of a plug for the exhibition, but that's not why you've come here this morning. Look, I'm very pleased to welcome Brad Argent here, who's going to tell you a little bit about Ancestry.com. I must admit it's a bit of a mystery to me. I have examined it, and of course we have it available in the exhibition. Isn't that right, Kerry? We do have it. Exactly, yes. I'd have to say it every Friday morning, by the way. I should mention this, that HEGSOG, the Heraldry and Genealogical Society of Canberra members, are here to help people do their Irish family history. So do bear that in mind. If you go to see the exhibition on a Friday morning, you can get their help in looking at specific Irish problems. And believe me, they're very, very, very skilled in doing that. But Ancestry.com is available there. I've had a bit of a look at it myself. I'm delighted to say that I have found ancestors on Ancestry.com. I sort of knew where they were, but it was delightful to see. But I did find one record that I didn't know about. I have a very unusual family in early 19th century Ireland and an unusual name, so it wasn't all that difficult. But it was tremendous to actually see it there. But anyway, it's my great pleasure to introduce Brad, who's going to tell you this morning a little bit about how Ancestry.com works. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you, Richard. Well, good morning, and thank you for taking the time out of your day to listen to me rabbit on about our product. Can I get a show of hands of people who've used it? Okay, good. What I'm going to do is just take you through some of the record sets that we have, why they're good. I'm also going to talk about a couple of things that I've got that's coming up as well, which is going to be interesting because it's actually going to impact almost everybody in this room, with the exception of Prue, but only because she doesn't falls outside the demographic. I'm sorry. And then I'm going to go and have a look. I'm going to dive onto the site and show you a couple of the things that I do when I'm using the site to help me sort of weave my way through the 6 billion records that are there. And I'm sure you've all had that problem where your ancestor never comes to the top. And occasionally they like to tell you that you should look at this American record before you look at this Australian record. All right, well, this is one of the things that I think I'm most proud about is the birth, marriage and death records that we have. Anybody who's done any family history in Australia prior to the launch of this collection would know that there wasn't anywhere you could go to search for an ancestor across the country. You had to go to a particular registry and search their indexes. And they varied in terms of what was available online, what wasn't available online, how you searched them, and how you actually accessed them. So what we did is we decided to pull all those together. And so now we have about, I think it's actually more than 15 million now because we've updated it, records from every state in Australia. So you can go to that one spot and search for that ancestor. And this is really important because I think when we do family history, we start out with this preconceived idea that our ancestors came to a particular state and they married and died there and their family lived there forever because that's where I'm living now. The reality, I think, is very different. I think our ancestors liked to move about. Some of them, I'm sure you've all got these in your trees somewhere, they just disappear. You see them being born, and then they're not there anymore. Where have they gone? There's no death record, there's no marriage record. Well, Since we put this collection up, I've had an enormous number of people come to me and say, I found them. In fact, I had one researcher who had 30 years' experience, and they found somebody in their own tree in this collection, simply because they were from Victoria, and they said, I know they'd gone to South Australia, but I could never find them in Victoria or South Australia. They found them in Queensland, in the Queensland death records. They still have no idea what they were doing in Queensland, to die in Queensland, but they never thought to look there. But of course, because we put the records up, they just typed in a name and clicked search, and there it was. So being able to do that, I think, is an enormous benefit. I always make the joke that I did this because I was just too lazy to go and look at every single site, and I just wanted the one spot to go and look for stuff. And for those of you who haven't seen it, this is what it looks like. Now, they are indexes, and they're not birth certificates. So this is a really important thing. Your birth certificates and your marriage certificates and death certificates still sit with the registry. Now, in New South Wales, you can order a certificate, or it's much cheaper to order a transcript. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about a transcript, apart from the fact that it's cheaper, and I think it's about $16 to $18 versus $35 or something, so it's a significant difference. A transcript is not a legal document, so you can't use it in court, but it's a transcript. And when they are transcribing the record, what they do is they write down everything. And I mean everything. So they will write down father's name, and then they'll put in brackets next to it, crossed out. Now, if you order a certificate, the certificate will come and the father's name will be blank. So sometimes getting a transcript gives you more information than getting a certificate. And, of course, getting a transcript always gives you the benefit of somebody else actually reading it and actually understanding it. And I still get certificates myself that I look at and I go, I've got no idea what that says. So transcripts are great. If you've got Victorian ancestors, you can get your certificates immediately online through the Victorian Registry, and that is fantastic. It turns out to be quite cheap, but then because you can get them immediately, you have a tendency to sit down and spend $50 or $60 in 5 minutes. But it's just so wonderful to be able to just go straight back and get that material immediately. So what you get in these indexes is you get a name, you get the spouse, this is a marriage one, you get the spouse's name, you will get a date, and you'll get a place. The important things to remember with these particular indexes is they are the registration of events. They are not the actual occurrence of events. So, and that's really important with birth records, because there can be a gap between when the birth occurs and when the birth is registered. And even today, the registry is inundated with registrations of birth at the start of the year for all these children that are 4 and 5 years old who want to go to school. So it still happens, and you still get that today. You certainly get that historically. So if this Bartholomew T. Bradman that I'm pointing at here, everything else is the same, but you think, well, no, he was born in 1899. That's probably the guy you're after. It's just maybe they took their time to get to the registry. And you've got to remember, it was probably men who were doing this. So, you know, what we're like, we don't always get to things immediately. Another important thing to remember about, particularly about birth records, is think a little laterally with the name, right? Because with your name, and I've seen this happen, it can change. They can be born one thing, and by the time they get to the registry, the name is something else. And that's because the husband has decided on the way to the registry office that they want to change the name. And I know people who have only discovered that their birth name was different when they were getting married and needed to get a birth certificate. So there can be some variation around that. And of course, people can spend their lives being, you know, Dorothy, but being known as Maud for some strange family reason. And you'll never find the Maud in the birth records, but Dorothy will be there. So there's things to think about with that. When you come to death records, of course, there's a whole heap of challenges around death records too. The usual joke being that they're never filled out by the deceased. So you never, the quality of the information in there varies depending on who filled out the death certificate. Now, there was a point in Australia's history where it was a responsibility of the person on whose property the deceased passed away to fill out the death certificate. Now, if you've got an ancestor like I've got, who was, you know, working at a mine in Newcastle in the start of the 20th century, and he died a long way from his family, the people who filled out the death certificates were his workmates. So they only put on the death certificate the information that they knew. And often you'll find, the thing that I always see on these things that gets confused is the parents of the deceased. You can sometimes find that the mother is right, but the father isn't their father, it's their father-in-law. So there'll be some confusion around exactly who they are. So think a little bit laterally about that. My preference is to always go with marriage records, because usually they're all adults involved, not always, but usually. Most of the time, it's a happy occasion. And there's usually a level of officiation around the process. So there's a usually some kind of religious service involved that's kind of putting pressure on people to be accurate with the information that they're giving. And we're blessed in Australia because our marriage records are fantastic. If you've got a marriage certificate from the UK, you'll no doubt be a little bit disappointed with the lack of information in them. But ours are fantastic. So I have this hierarchy where I go, marriage records first, then birth records, and then death records, in terms of a preference about what I get. You get so much from a marriage record that sometimes the birth records are not absolutely necessary to get you back to that next branch. But it's not just Australian records on the site. We have, as many of you are probably aware, the UK birth, marriage and death indexes. They go from 1837 up to 2005. They are now fully indexed. It's much easier to search than it was previously. And, of course, you can order a certificate directly from the site. Now, I'm obliged by my marketing people to tell you that. And now I'm going to take my ancestry hat off and tell you it's very expensive. It's much cheaper to go directly to the GRO, which is the registry in the UK, and order the certificate. So get your necessary information that you need to order the certificate from Ancestry and then go to the GRO or go to your Family History Society and ask them to order it for you. I think it ends up costing around about $50 Australian to get a certificate from Ancestry. Keep in mind, you do that, and I ordered one and it was in my email in 6 days, which is fantastic. But I paid for it. I paid a premium for the electronic delivery. Compare that. For that price, I could have got 2 certificates just by going through the Family History Society and quite possibly 3 by going to the GRO. So it's a service. It's there. Yeah, sure. It's the Government Registry Office or General Registry Office or... Yeah, thank you. Yeah, look, if you want me to clarify anything as we go, just throw something at me and ask a question. They are fantastic records, but they're not the only thing that you should look at. Because there's a whole heap of things, you've got this whole process of civil registration, which didn't start in Australia till about the 1850s. It varied from state to state. In the UK, it's 1837. And this civil registration is the government getting involved and telling people they had to register these events. because prior to that, it's all parish church records. We have a cemetery index. It's about 500,000 records in there. And I've kind of made it one of my goals is to get as many of these cemetery records together as I can. Again, because people have this habit of not dying where they're supposed to die. And, you know, I don't like loose ends, so I like to have the death recorded. And I'm getting these records, and I'm adding to them slowly and slowly, and I'm slowly building up this database of Australian cemetery records. And they can be wonderful because you can get things like monumental inscriptions. Now, that's, you know, what people have written on a tombstone, and sometimes that can tell you much, much more than you'll ever get from a death certificate. Now, one of the more interesting birth, marriage and death collections is Gretna Green marriage records. Now, if I say Gretna Green, does it mean anything to anybody? Yeah, I'm sure it does. It's laughingly called the Las Vegas of England. And this is what they look like. Right? So they're not the easiest record to read. But Gretna Green was a place on the border between England and Scotland where you didn't really need a whole heap of documentation to get married. And people would often go there and get married if they couldn't, for a variety of reasons, get married in their own parish or their own country. So it's ancillary records like this that can help you when you can't find a marriage record in the traditional records. So one of the things I always try and point out is just because you can't find a record for it doesn't mean it didn't happen. All right? Now, I'll give you a good example of that. Seeing as I'm in the nation's capital, our Prime Minister, when I was doing her family history, her grandfather and grandmother, I couldn't find a marriage record for them anywhere. And I looked really hard for this record. And what looks like happened was she married this guy, this Percy Gillard, and he went to war and he died during the war, First World War, I think it was. And I think she ended up, after he died, she took up with his brother. Now, I couldn't find a marriage record, and it's quite possible that they didn't actually marry because they weren't allowed to marry. But just because I couldn't find the record doesn't mean that it didn't happen. You know what it's like. It could be fallen down the back of a filing cabinet somewhere. It might be indexed incorrectly. And it might be indexed in such a way that we're never going to find it unless we stumble across it. But just because, evidence of absence is not... absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So just because it's not there doesn't mean it didn't happen. So don't get this shock if you go looking for your great-grandparents' marriage record and you can't find it. And you think, oh, my God, they were never married. Maybe they weren't, but maybe they were, and it just doesn't appear in the records. It might be in one of these kind of ancillary record sets. Now, Gretna Green is quite a small collection, about 4,000 or 5,000 records, I think. It's quite tiny. The likelihood of you finding an ancestor in there is small, but unless you look, you're never going to know. So don't rule it out. If you hit these roadblocks in the big collections, look at the smaller ones. And this is something I'm probably going to reinforce a million times today, is don't just look online. You know? Online family history is a gateway drug to history. Okay? It's not the mother lode. You've got to get to your archives, to your family history societies. That's where the good data is. That's where all the stories are told. Online stuff will build the skeleton. The meat on the bones will come from the archive. So you need to think outside the square a little bit. London parish records. This was, I think, a huge boon. Well, certainly was for me. Some of my ancestors came from London. And Again, this is the stuff that goes back before civil registration. 1538, right? That's way, way back. Now, okay, at the 1538 end of the spectrum, there's not a lot of people. And I think actually some of those records are in Latin. But as you move obviously further forward in that, and these records here are from 1720s, you do get more and more people. And I always tell this story about this particular record set. And I was working with... I was giving a talk, actually, at a family history conference at the weekend that we launched this material. And there was a woman there who had been over to London and looked at these parish registers herself, and she had paid three professional genealogists in a period of 20 years to go and look at these records to find her ancestor. After digitising them and indexing them, she sat down with me, and in 90 seconds, we'd found that person she was looking for. Simply because we had gone through this process of digitising and indexing them. And, you know, he was sitting down here at the bottom of the page. Really quite obvious when you saw it, but we've all done that thing where we look at a record set 100 times and we can't see it, and somebody just walks in, looks over our shoulder and goes, there it is. And it was one of those moments. And I said to her, well, it was worth £1 million then, wasn't it, just so that you could find that ancestor. But it's moments like that that do make it worthwhile. Now, you probably can't make this out, but there is an Australian connection to this particular collection, and I don't know if that makes it any better. But this says Arthur, son of Jacob and Elizabeth Philip. I think that's Philip's. That's Arthur Philip's baptismal record. And the beauty of this is it also has his birth date in there, as well as his baptismal date. And it has his parents in there. And that's 1727 or 28. And so by getting these kind of records and going into parish records, you can jump back so far, so quickly. And particularly if you've got one of those families that didn't move, they'll be in there. One thing I do find with these records is families like to do group baptisms. So it's quite often that you will see two or three children being baptised at the same time. And of course, I was looking in these records about 8 weeks ago for somebody. And again, I was out at a family history conference, and this woman came up to me and said, I'm looking for John Smith, son of John Smith, from London. And it's one of those things that you dread, you know, when someone asks you that kind of a question. But we found him, which amazed me, because I thought, I'm never going to do this. And we found him in the records because it was John Smith. And she said, oh, he was a blacksmith from this area. And because that was recorded in the record, we were able to find the information. And she found a sister that she was not aware of who was baptised on the same day. So, you know... I would have thought that would have been impossible to do. But the beauty of having everything digitised and having these indexes that you can search just made the process that much simpler. It took us about 15 minutes of weaving our way through the records, because there's a couple of John Smiths in London. But we got there, you know? And I think, to me, that's one of the huge boons of the internet, is that it enables us to do this. And it's finally we have a productive use for the internet. Now, passenger lists. These are really important because we are a nation of immigrants. 98% of us came from somewhere else in the last 223 years. And so what I'm doing, much as we did with the birth, marriage and death records, what I've done with the ancestry site here in Australia is I've gone around and I've got all the passenger records, or as many of them as I can get. And I'm starting to throw them up together, because we all get to that point in our family tree where there are no more people in Australia and they've come from somewhere. And the struggle is, well, where did they come from? Now, if you've very fortunate and you have an assisted immigrant in your ancestry. The records are fantastic. They are just wonderful because they are so rich. There's the assisted immigration records for New South Wales, which are absolutely fantastic. It's a similar set for Victoria. There's things like immigration deposit journals, which tell you who assisted the immigrant to come out. It will say who they know in the colony, which can always be an insight into, oh, I didn't know that that family was here as well. And it can sometimes answer the question as to why. And Rich and I were talking about this earlier, and it's one of the things that always amazes me. It's like, why? Why Australia and why then? You know, why did we end up here and not in America or in Canada? You know, why this end of the world? And why, you know, why this hemisphere? And the immigration records, I think, are the part of the key to answering that question. And what you'll get in an immigration record, typically, and they do vary wildly, you'll get a name, you'll get an estimated birth year, usually, not always. You'll get an arrival date. You'll get an arrival port, departure port, a ship name, and sometimes a nationality, which is good. But there are issues with the immigration records. Yes?
Is there a reason why
The question was, if you didn't hear it, why don't we have other states there? And I will get to that more broadly. The particular question was about South Australia. We don't have a lot of records for South Australia, full stop. South Australia represents a challenge. Anybody who's done research in South Australia will probably agree with that.
Can I just say, because I did get information from the Maritime
Museum,
whatever.
Yeah, and there are great records. There are good records for South Australia. I wouldn't say they're great, but there are good records for South Australia. And again, and this just goes back to the point I was saying before. You've got to think outside the box. Right? We don't have all the answers. We have a lot of them, but we certainly don't have all of them. And if you can't find it here, there's a million other places that you can look for information, and I do go into that. Actually, at the end of this, I've got a slide that lists a whole heap of other websites to look at. South Australia is challenging, and it's not like we haven't asked, and asked repeatedly, but they're not... they're different. I'll just be diplomatic and leave it at that. I'm a very patient man, so I will be chipping away at that iceberg with my toothpick for some time.
Can I just ask you to do that?
Sure. Yeah? We do. We have Queensland records from 1848 to 1912. We don't have those records yet. I've been in discussion with Queensland on and off for 4 years. And at the moment, it's off. But it could be on again tomorrow. So, look, getting access to these records is a very, very challenging exercise. When you walk into an archive and you say, I'd like to get access to your records, I'd like to digitise them, index them and put them up on a website and make money from it, there's 50,000 questions that they have to which I have the answer to about four of them. There's huge issues around what does that mean in terms of access? Do they have the right to do that? Questions around copyright, questions around publishing, questions around privacy that we have to go into. Some archives and some government bodies have one mindset around that. Others have different mindsets around that. And they have a whole heap of sensitivities that they need to work with as well. And then it comes down to priority. For an archive, for example, like Queensland, the priority is cataloguing. Making sure they know what they've got is a huge priority, as you can imagine. Because, you know, when you've got 70 kilometres of shelving, you probably want to know what's on it, because it makes it much easier to find the stuff. And so things like digitising and indexing and working with third parties to do that probably get bumped down on the sort of priority list, which is frustrating for me and ultimately frustrating for those of us who want to use the material. But, you know, we work with them. And look, it took us 2.5 years to get our first agreement in Australia, and I had to change the law in New South Wales to do that. So that gives you some insight into the kind of input that goes into it. We do have... what material we have is an index, so it's very much looking like this, but there aren't any images attached with it because we take the position that the images in the film are a creative work that is owned by the archive, in the broadest sense of the word and without prejudice. That's essentially our position. Yes. Yes.
With something like New South Wales, where there are two separate shipping lists, the agents lists and the boards lists, do you then get both?
You do, and this is one of the struggles that we are kind of coming to terms with. Is we bundle stuff and we say, oh, it's an immigration record or it's a passenger record, and of course, there's in the New South Wales one, for example, there's 8 or 9 series of records in that set. And we're actually working with the archive now so that we can delineate which series of records it came from, because that's really important. You want to know exactly what the originating agency was for a particular record, because there could be 100 other records that support it that just aren't online. So we are getting to that. Yes. That star system is how close a match it is to the criteria that you put in the search. And I'm going to go through that. I'm going to dive into the site and do a little bit of searching to show you what that looks like. Now, this is an immigration record. This is an interesting record set because it is an unassisted immigration record, which is the vast bulk of people coming into Australia, particularly in the later half of the 20th century. The 19th century. The interesting thing is most of our seamen here actually get reasonably well written up. If you've got a sailor or a maritime person in your ancestry, the records are wonderful. You can see them popping in and out of various ports around Australia many, many times. You'll get here, and again, I'm saying this is something of an anomaly, but you do get here, this is a name, this is, I can't even read that myself, this could be, it looks like there's an age there of children, this might be a relationship to people. Here is an address where they're going in Sydney, which is absolutely wonderful. Most of the time, it will be Mr. Smith and family. Is it your Mr. Smith? Who knows? But, there are other things that you can do if you think that's yours. For example, this has happened a number of times. This ship is called Matilda's? Matilda's? If it was just Mr. Smith and family, and it just so happened that he lived at a property, your ancestor lived at a property called Matilda's, well, there's a strong possible connection between that. And you do sometimes find that things that are important to them in terms of their process of coming to the country get some kind of connection with the family moving down, whether it's a surname or a middle name that's passed on, whether it's a ship, the ship name is brought into the family story at some point. So there are other things, but I picked this record in particular because there's something on there that you probably couldn't see until I blew it up. There are stowaways. And I've yet to find any comprehensive research on the stowaways that came to Australia. And as I'm sort of randomly browsing through the record sets, and indeed that's how I found these, I'm sort of putting them to one side and saying there's stowaways on here, but we don't treat them any different. So they're actually listed as passengers. I've yet to find anybody who has found a stowaway ancestor. But, you know, here's five. And look at the, let me look at the information. There's more information on them than you'll get on some, you know, legitimate passengers. Their name, their age, and their occupation. So there is good information in there. Now, I've got to talk about convicts because they're so important. Important to certainly the building of Australia in the very early days. They probably don't play as big a role as our free settlers or our assisted immigrants play in terms of building and expanding the nation. But these were the poor souls who, for whatever reason, were sent out here. And there's a couple of myths about convicts, and they're quite hotly debated. I think the vast bulk of them were just habitual criminals or opportunistic criminals, and they finally got caught and sent here. I think that whole myth about them, you know, having to steal to put bread on the table and being hard done by, I'm sure that happened on occasion, but the vast bulk of them certainly appear to be recidivist criminals who just finally got caught. And for some of them, they were caught more than once. They weren't violent criminals, and that's the big thing. I think only 2% of convicts were actually violent or convicted of violent crimes, because, of course, any violent crime, you got hung, because it was the period of the Bloody Code where, you know, you steal a handkerchief and you get sentenced to death, and it gets obviously converted to transportation for life. But we have an enormous amount of convict records on the site, and too many to go into. It is probably the most comprehensive set of Australian convict records you will find anywhere. And we did these records a little while ago, the Certificates of Freedom. Now, not every convict obviously got one of these, because some of them got sentenced for life, and life is what they served. But they're a great record set, and they're worth looking at just for this general remarks section down here. This goes into, and I'm going to try and read it. I think it's a bit of a physical description of this Peter McCabe. He's a small, flaring, small hairy mole. You can read it better than I can. And it talks about him being moved somewhere and serving some time somewhere else. And this wonderful chunk of information about this convict here. If you've got a convict, you're blessed with an enormous amount of documentation. You know, if you've got a free settler, you can see them coming and you might see them dying, and that might be about it. But there's just way too much to go into, but the Certificates of Freedom are a wonderful collection. Most of the records on Ancestry, you have to purchase. You can, of course, get access to Ancestry downstairs in the Irish exhibition. They have Ancestry down there for the duration of the exhibition, so it's well worth getting in there and having a look. I think the National Library has Ancestry, so you can go and you can use that for free. And I think there's a number of other places around here that have free access. So there's, you know, you can get access to it for free. It's not expensive, but of course I'm going to say that. I think it's good value for money. But then, of course, I'm going to say that too. Yeah, you can make up your own mind. There's other things here like registers of conditional and absolute pardons. Again, a wealth of information in that kind of convict material. We are currently working on the convict ship surgeons' journals as well, which are fascinating accounts of actually what transpired on the convict journeys, and it talks about the convicts who got sick. And Wonderful stuff. I mean, some of this, they write a description about this illness on this convict, and it might go for one or two pages. And then there'll just be another entry for a convict so-and-so died. And that's it. There doesn't seem to be any real consistency about it in those records, but they're coming, and they're good records as well. We're also working on the convict indents, which I'm sure if you've got a convict you've seen before. Yes?
Just a quick question. This is most amazing, the doctoral award. Are those records available in archives as descriptions of the smallpox on the boat to debunk, you know, why Army Annie went blind on the boat with smallpox? Do they do it?
From memory, with relation to the convicts in particular, the convict ship surgeon's journals are part of the ADM, which is the Admiralty 101 record series from the National Archive, and they have been filmed by the National Library, and they are part of what's called the AJCP, or the Australian Joint Copying Project. So there is film for that, and you will find that film at the National Library, and I think it's at the relevant state libraries as well. It is wonderful, wonderful material. And there, if you haven't had a look at what is in that, take some time and have a look and just browse through the catalogues. And I think the catalogues are like about this thick. There is a wealth of stuff in there. And again, that's the kind of stuff you need to flesh out the story. It's one thing to know that they existed. It's another thing entirely to know who they were. Now, electoral rolls. These are really important for us as Australians because we don't have any surviving census records. Well, we do. We have 1828, as you know. And we have both copies of that on Ancestry. And I say both because there were two that were produced. And it looks like they sent the draft copy back to England and kept the original copy here. And in fact, I think the original copy was actually updated after the copy that was sent to England. So we have both copies so that you can do compare and contrast. If you want a definitive source on the 1828 census, there is a book and CD published by Mal Senti and Keith Johnson that is very well worth getting access to. I'm sure they have a copy at the Family History Society and at the library, but it's a definitive work, and it's actually the work that I use when I'm doing research, and then I dive back into the ancestry images. But we have that, we have the 1828, then we have the 1841 heads of household, and then we have some partial records for New South Wales for 1881 and 1891. And then our next surviving census happens in 1961. So there's this huge gap. And of course the 1961 census won't be available until 2060, which is a little bit outside of my time frame. So what electoral rolls, they seem to me to be the next sort of resource to go for. We had compulsory registration, and then we had compulsory voting. So they are an adult census, if you like. A great range of dates there. You will notice that South Australia is not included in that. The story behind that is these records came from the filming of the electoral rolls that was done by the National Library. When they filmed them, they asked South Australia to provide their records. They would film them and they would give them back copies of the film. And South Australia said, no, thank you. So they're not in there. If anybody has a copy of those, please come and see me afterwards. As you can see, great information in an electoral roll. And I'm sure you've all seen them at some point, but and, you know, they covered off everybody. There's the big man himself as a student. Um, They can be really good for putting somebody somewhere at a point, at a place, at a point in time. I use them extensively when I'm trying to search back for someone. When I'm doing a piece of research on a famous person, for example, I will use the electoral rolls to try and work out when they might have got married. And you can sometimes you can see that because here they are living at home. Next electoral roll, they're not living at home and they're living with another person who has the same surname. Okay, well that gives me given names for their, perhaps for their spouse. So you can use them and you can use them to reverse engineer that process and get some data out of it. What is interesting about these, and what I alluded to at the start of my talk, is we're going up to 1980. So that means for most of you, you will be in the records. And I wonder how you're going to feel about that. Somebody told me that that was the definition of getting old, was actually appearing in the Ancestry database. Now, I stopped at 1980 for no other reason than it just kind of felt wrong to go any more recent than that. It does a number of things. It covers off the referendum that we had in the 60s. And it also covers off the change of the voting age in 75. And it's, there are wonderful records, and particularly wonderful records for people who are getting started. I don't think I'll do any further than 1980. We released a whole heap of New Zealand records earlier this year, and those electoral rolls go up to 81, I think. And I think that's soon enough, you know. I don't think we need to go, even though under law we could go right up to 2008. I don't think we need to, you know. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Now, when I asked a number of people about doing that and how they felt about us putting that information up there, just trying to get some feedback. Because, and you know, if you were previously married, there might be an electoral roll record with you and your previous spouse living at the same address. If that marriage didn't work out, and you had another marriage and your life moved on and your family didn't know about that marriage, there's a possibility that they could find that out. And that was the case I put forward when I was talking to people, that that might be the worst case scenario that comes out of this. They didn't care. They said, well, you know, people can get access to marriage records. They were more worried about the openness of marriage records more broadly than they were about what was on the electoral rolls. So I think it's going to be an enormous boon for us to track down, for those people who want to get started, particularly for those who decide that they want to do their family history once their parents are dead. It's probably a little late to get started. And you know what it's like. You always lament that you always start too late when you do family history. So what have we got that's coming up? Well, we do have more passenger lists. We have West Australia, and we have Tasmania. West Australia is very important, and it has something like 2.9 million people coming into Australia. And that is just a period from 1873 to 1932. So not a huge chunk of time, but an enormous number of people. And, of course, they came in there, and then they went everywhere. So if you can't find your ancestor coming into Victoria or coming into New South Wales, think about them coming into Western Australia. Tasmania is one of those places that it's been around for a long, long time. It was really our second colony. About 1810, they sort of started having information of that. The Tasmanian records actually go up to 1970. And they will be up with images. And just between you and me, we're launching those on the 14th of July. So, and I think in total that brings our immigration collection up to about 14.6 million people coming into Australia. We're doing the convict indents, as I said. We are doing the Colonial Secretary's papers. Now, can I have a show of hands of people who've looked at the Colonial Secretary's papers? Wonderful record set. There is a fantastic calendar that's been done by New South Wales State Records. And what we've done is we've taken that calendar and we've married it up to the microform images. And so now you can search the calendar and then click on it to see the image. And that collection will be a free collection. Right? So that will be free for everybody. And the reason that we did that is because these are the fundamental set of records that really document the building of Australia. And it kind of didn't feel right to put those records behind a paved wall. You know? And it's such a wonderful resource for kids who are doing research on early Australia to be able to get in there and see the letter that William Bligh sent asking for, you know, his personal effects to be returned. To get in there and get a real sense of the voice of Australia as it was growing up. And I think you have an obligation to make that stuff accessible. So we worked in partnership with New South Wales State Records to make that happen. It's going to be available by Australia Day next year. It may be available before then. We're getting more electoral rolls, as I spoke of, and of course we're getting more UK parish records, and of course more Irish material. There's a wealth of Irish material on the site, which you can have a look at if you go down to the exhibition. There is a heap of stuff there. We've got a whole heap of parish records too, I think, that we've recently indexed for Ireland Catholic parish records. And there's also records, and I think these are fascinating records, of the famine and the letters that are petitioned from... And you might not find your ancestor in those records, but it will give you a real sense of, particularly if you have Irish ancestors who came here during that period, it will give you a real sense of what it was like for them and perhaps what the motivations were for them to leave. But I love doing family history on the cheap. And we are blessed with some great free sites. And I've just put down here a couple that I use on a daily basis. Now, the first one is the Australian Cemetery Index by Reg McDowell. Travels around the country photographing and indexing cemeteries. So if you go to this site, chances are there'll not only be an index, but a digital photo of the headstone, which is just absolutely fantastic. Because there's no way you're going to be able to make it to every cemetery in Australia. So, and of course, these are all free sites. Ryerson Index, who hasn't used Ryerson? Oh, you've got to go to the Ryerson Index and have a look. Death records, there's about 3 million of them, and they're from the death notices in a whole heap of Australian papers. What I do with that is I go in and I find the death notice, and then I pop down to the State Library and go through the microfilm reels of the newspaper and read the death notice. Death notices are wonderful because they'll often mention people in the death notice who you've never heard of. It will usually give you a full account of who the offspring were of the deceased. It might mention a spouse that you're not aware of. It can give you details of where the funeral was and perhaps where the burial was, which can then drive you on to a cemetery record. Who hasn't used Trove? Who's game enough to put their hand up and say they haven't used it? Look, I would have to say it is probably the world's leading website for newspaper research. They have spent an enormous amount of money and spent it very, very well in providing us with a free digitised copy of a whole raft of newspapers that are really pertinent to Australia. Look, There's nothing else I can say to you, but go there and have a look, but block out 2 or 3 hours. Because you get there and you will find a letter to the Sydney Morning Herald that your ancestors sent 100 years ago. You'll find, as I did, that your great-grandparents or your great-great-grandparents divorced at the age of 63. And then you go and you tell your grandmother that and she had absolutely no idea. So you find these, the stuff that you find in there is just wonderful, but it, you know, it is a time vampire. And so you need to be careful, but it is such a wonderful resource. And, you know, I just can't praise it highly enough. Go home and do it now. You can. It's based on OCR, or optical character recognition, where they've scanned it and they've converted all the text into words. So it's kind of hit and miss. But the beauty of Trove is if you find a record that's you're interested in, you can go in and you can update it and transcribe it. So you can correct any of the errors that the software might have picked up, and that sort of stuff, which then has enormous benefits for everybody else. And you can tag it as well. So you can put surnames in the tag field, which then helps people when they're doing searching. It's a wonderful, interactive, community-based project that I can't do enough to support it. It's, yeah, like, you know, out of all the sites on there, I'd say it's the one, if you haven't been to it, go home, have a look. Of course, Papers Past is a New Zealand version of that. Don't discount New Zealand from your searching. There's a huge amount of interaction between Australia and New Zealand going back as early as the 1840s. If you have an ancestor who's just disappeared, have a look in New Zealand. Often if they came here, and they came here for something like a gold rush or something, and they couldn't make it here, they just hopped the boat over to try their luck in New Zealand. So don't discount that. I mean, there's a huge amount of traffic to and fro. So Papers Past is a good way of getting in and just having a look at who's in there. I actually used that quite extensively when I was doing Russell Crowe's ancestry. He's got one of those ancestries you just die for. Every branch of his tree, someone was from a different country. Germany, Italy, South Africa. He has Maori connections. He's got English connections, Canadian connections. There's connections with one of the Italian revolutions. It's just every branch of every branch I shook, strange fruit fell out. It was absolutely wonderful, which probably answers a whole heap of other questions about Mr. Crowe. Of course, the National Archive. Again, it's a must-do. You know, you've got to look at that site. Whenever I'm doing research, I always do a search there as well. These are the sites that I use every time I'm looking for somebody. Now, of course, I use Ancestry, but you know, you've got to think outside that box as well. And of course, your state-based archives and your registries and your family history societies. Now, they're really important. If you can trace an ancestor back to a particular spot, chances are there's going to be some record for them sitting on a shelf in a family history society somewhere. It could be somebody else has already done the family history, but they did it 30 years ago and it's sitting in a book on the shelf. It could be an employment record that's sitting in the Lithgow Family History Society because it's, you know, they worked at an arms factory up there. You just don't know these things, so you have to think, okay, they came from this area, where's the local history or the family history group for that? If you can't find them on the web, ring up the local library and ask the question. You know, the internet, as I said, is the starting place. It's not the start and the end. Now, I'm going to open it up to questions, but while I do that, I thought I'd just show you some of the stuff on the site. This is me. This is my Ancestry subscription. When I log in, this is the page that I get. I don't spend a lot of time on that. Over here, you can see I've got some quick links for me to use, but what the first thing I do is I go in and I search all records. Now, you can see the drop-down box here gives me an option of filtering out these categories just a bit. But, and I also always have the advanced search open. It just gives me a little bit more control over what I do. And you can see here too, and this is really important if you want to filter out all that US rubbish that they try and give you, is you make sure your collection priority is Australian. And you, if you tick this box, it will only show you records that are Australian. Now, there's risks associated with that, because you could have an ancestor who is Australian but served in the First World War and enrolled in America. And if you have that box ticked, you're never going to find them. So, you know, I always... There's two ways of searching, right? You can start and you can put in everything you know and you click search and you get no results. Or you can put in just the name and click search and you get 3 million results. Somewhere between the two is a happy medium. So I usually start out by putting in a minimum of information. I'll put in a name, a place, and a date. And I think if you don't have those three things, it's going to be a struggle to find what you're after. And then I might add more information to try and filter it down. But a couple of the things that you can do on Ancestry, which are really interesting, is you can do... I'm just going to do a surname search. Now, Argent is quite an uncommon name. So I can do things like this. I can put a question mark in there. Right? Which is really interesting with a vowel like E, because it can be read as O or A or I, depending on the quality of the person who is actually writing the original record. So by putting a question mark in there, it will give me every one of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't necessarily give you the result you wanted. There's probably a better way of doing that. Now, you can see here it's giving me a whole heap of Argents with an E. And I'll just try and see if I can show you. I mean, it comes in handy if you're doing something like Smith and Smythe. Yeah, and of course it's only bringing up Argents as it would normally do. Okay, all right. Let me give you another example.
Can I replace one letter with
a question mark? Yes, yeah, it's only one letter. If you wanted to do more, you can do this. Put an asterisk in. Now, you can put that asterisk anywhere, at the start or at the end. You need three characters. Now, you're going to have... The more characters that you have, the more narrow your result will be. For example, I wouldn't suggest that you put asterisks and then S-O-N because you'll get a huge number. But if I do that, you'll see that I get a number of different results. So there you can see I'm getting some Argents, but the first thing that came up was that. Now, that's because it's sorted the results alphabetically. If I wanted to thin those down a little bit, I can put in a date. Thomas Argument. I find it rather difficult to believe that his surname was Argument, but, you know. And again, this comes in really handy when you're looking for variations on a theme. And then you've got this thing here. I can go and I can narrow it down by category here. So, and you can see how the star system's kind of coming into play here. Now, that's also based on the fact that all I've asked it to search for is three characters to limit the record search to Australia, which has about 100 million records in it. And it's given me 25,000 results. If I want to slim it down a little bit more, I can put in William. If I want to make it a little bit more, I can actually do this. I can actually restrict it to exact. Now, again, if you go with the default settings, it uses a kind of sound deck, so it will give you a variety of different things, and it will use things that might be William, might be transcribed incorrect, William, but transcribed wrong. If I restrict it to exact, it will only give me exact instances of William. Now, it will give me William Arthur, it will give me Arthur William, and it will give me William. But as you can see, it's already knocked it down to 4,000. Argue. I wonder if they're related to the argument people. Of course, I know I'm looking for William Argent. And if I restrict that down to exact as well, it goes from 4,000 down to 156. Now, I'm looking for particularly for an immigration record. Sadly, he wasn't a convict. And then, okay, he's there, but he's not there. Because I know what record set he's in, and he's not. Why isn't he coming up in these records? So I'm going to change that back to default and see what happens. Because I know he's there, you know? I know he came here. And in fact, I know he's here because I used the old school method of finding him by going through reels and reels of immigration microfiche records. Is he an assisted passenger? Or like, I know he is. And in fact, I know that that's him. Now, he was William Argent, but his actual name was Arthur William Argent. And you can see, if you see down here, that's been corrected. Because it isn't Arthur A, it's actually Arthur W, and I made that correction. So if I went in there and I searched for Arthur W now, that record would come up, because I've actually made an amendment to that because the transcription was wrong. Now, I'm going to try and view this record. Now, there he is. And that clearly says Arthur A. But I know that he was Arthur William. Yes, it's a question I'm making. Yeah. No, I possibly... Did I? I did too. Look at that. Well, I'm going to go in and correct it. I'm going to go and add another one. And I can put in here an explanation. It's going to want a reason. Cool. And you can see there that there's two. That first one is me. I have to accept a mea culpa for that.
On the original record,
yep.
You made the change.
It does, yes. If you go back... Yes, where you see that little pencil, it means somebody has contributed to that record. Now, we get an enormous number of user contributions, in the tens of thousands per week globally. That could be... The spin on that is that our work records are just wonderfully interactive and people like to update them. It's also a comment on the transcribing process and the indexing process. And what you have to remember is indexes are finding aids. They're not transcriptions, okay? So they are designed to drive you to the original record. So if you can find your ancestor, but the surname's not spelled 100% correct, not such an issue if you can find your ancestor. We constantly try and drive up quality, but of course an increase in quality can lead to an increase in cost. I can give you 100% accurate transcriptions of records, but I'd have to stick a zero on the end of your subscription cost, and I don't think anybody would want to pay that. So it's kind of trying to find a balance between that, and getting people to update the records like this is one way that we can do that, and we can improve upon the quality of the indexing. Yes?
Can I just ask, what's the difference between the version of ancestry that we use in the library and the version we subscribe to from home?
Yeah, look, that's the not a lot is the short answer to that. There are some things that you won't get, but they're very obscure US-based collections that, because of some legacy licensing issues, we can't put on the library edition. So there's, in terms of records, really, there's no material difference. What you will notice, though, is that you can't get access to family trees. You can't. And really, this is where the value really is. Searching the family trees, leveraging somebody else's research. Now, there's a really important point about that. Who has used the family trees stuff and taken somebody else's research? You've got to be really careful. You've got to be really, really careful. Make sure that the information that you're getting is sourced. Ideally, there's got to be two sources for it. It's a great time saver, but it does not take away the obligation that you have for actually going and doing research. I always say, use a family tree, someone else's family tree, as a roadmap. It might kind of point you in the right direction, but you still have to go on the journey. Yes? You can contact the owner. Yeah, and look, and this is a real struggle, and I think this is one of the things you have an obligation when you put your information up, and you're prepared to share it with the world. You have an obligation, I think, to interact with the world. So if somebody comes along and corrects you, and indeed, I've seen people almost come to blows over differences between what should be. I must tell you a funny story. I got a call from a guy who he rang me and he said, I'm not dead. I'm not dead, but there's a record on your site that says I'm dead. And he said, we need to fix it. So it took us a while. Again, he tried to contact the person, couldn't get through, didn't get a response. So we were able to intervene for him and contact the person directly. And he updated the record eventually. Got around it. It takes a little while, but it does happen. Yeah, you're welcome. And so it can work. And sometimes it just takes persistence. And I think one of the ways that you can counter it is to put your version up. And just to say, well, look, this is the way it is. But you've got to be really careful when you're sharing information, like a family tree. on the internet. And I'll show you why. This is my family tree. Now, it won't show information on living people, right? By default, it just hides that information. It will show information on deceased people. So think about that when you're doing that. So if you're, for example, putting up a family tree and it includes the death of somebody who might have died quite young and quite tragically, even if it was 20, 30 years ago, is it absolutely necessary for you to publish that bit of information? Because it might cause distress to somebody else. And then you've got to think about the same thing when you put photos up. You know, some people, some communities have an issue with images of the dead being represented. So think about that. Also think about the fact that when you put information up there and you make it publicly available, people might use it for purposes that you might not be comfortable with. They might take your information and misrepresent it. So I would always suggest that you, when you put information up, share only the information that you're comfortable sharing, and if someone wants more, they can contact you, and then you make a decision about what it is you're prepared to share and what you're not prepared to share. Yes.
So, if you join ancestry.au, do you also get access to
the UK? Yeah. You think about the different websites essentially as doorways, all into the same room. The difference being that the subscription that you pay for determines the list of cocktails that you can order from. Now, if you pay entry level into Australia, you get the basic Australian stuff and the basic UK stuff. You get enough information to get your, you know, you get your census records in the UK, you get your birth, marriage and death records in the UK, you get your Australian vitals and your Australian immigration records and your convict records. Then there's this sort of middle package, which gives you more Australian stuff, like jail records and the inquest records and that, and the parish records from the UK, so it can help you get back past that 1837 barrier. And then you have world. My advice to people is take out the basic, very basic entry-level subscription. If you find you're getting denied access to certain records, and it's just one or two, just make a note of them and then pop down to the library and get the records there. If you find that, oh my God, my family were in London and they were in London for 300 years, maybe it makes sense then to spend the extra money and get access to the London parish records. It's only an extra $50 a year, but that's, you know, a couple of birth certificates. That's, you know, getting some records from the National Archives. It's a trade-off. And then if you find yourself getting, you know, oh, I really need to get access to these US records, again, if it's only one or two, just get it from the library. If you find that, oh my God, there's a whole branch of the family in Canada that I never knew existed, then maybe it makes sense to upgrade to the world package. But, yeah, you know, I'd stay with the very basic package to start with and then make a really considered decision about do I need to bump up to the next level.
The world package, is that what other countries is answered?
Okay, America, obviously, Canada, Ireland, Scotland. Though I'd have to say Scotland's people's probably better for that at the moment. Look, England and Wales, obviously. Norway, Sweden, France, Germany, Italy. There's a whole heap of Chinese records there as well. Not yet, no. And then, of course, we're looking at, actually, only this last week I've been looking at where do we go next, what's important next for Australia. I don't know. What country's next on the list? Yes. Yes, they are all in Swedish, but what we have done is we've transcribed... The searching is in English, but the records are not in English. And that becomes a real problem when you've got to go and do that. Then you need to get translation of that records. But there's great places to get that. Where I recommend people go is go to a migration service, because a lot of migration services have in-house translators who can translate records for you. Or churches, or community groups, that sort of stuff. We need to wrap now. Yes. Scotland's people. You do. We have been trying for years and years to get material from Scotland, but which is why we've indexed all the census records, but... They just won't come to the party. So if you've got a lot of Scottish ancestors, Scotland's people, I would suggest it's the place to go. We've got to wrap it up, but thank you very much for your time, guys.
Okay, just a couple of things before we finish, before I thank Brad. Kerry, when's that Hagsog Day coming up on July? The one that I'm performing at.
That's...
So 31st July.
The first day is focused on Australian records.
Yeah, 31st. Right. And then the second day is
7th of August.
Okay, well, the lady was asking about matrons' diaries and on ships. Yes, I will actually be talking about that on that day. Well, stuff relating to voyages and a whole range of things, particularly about the Irish, but nonetheless it covers general stuff as well. And the second thing, just to acknowledge in what Brad was telling you about the state archive, or the state records, my God, state archives, I go back a long way, the state records of New South Wales, the indexes to the colonial secretaries material. Yes, up until 1823 the archives did that, but 1823 on was done by a genealogist, Joan Rees, who just spent, I don't know, a good part of her life doing the 1823 right through the rest of the century virtually record. So genealogists do a lot of very valuable things. Are you putting the whole index up?
We're putting the whole calendar that's currently up on the state records.
Okay, yeah. Well, most of that calendar is actually done by Joan, not by the state records themselves.
Yeah, and it is. It's one of the best I've ever seen.
It's an extraordinary record, Well, look, it just reminds me to thank Brad for giving up his time and coming here today to tell you about Ancestry.com. I was curious to sit and see what I might learn from it. I have learnt, actually. Thank you, Brad, for that. I definitely have. And I'm going to go back and do a couple of little searches for nothing. Down there, because it's available in the National Museum up until the end of June anyway, in the Irish Exhibition. Make sure you go and see the Irish Exhibition. You can use it for free there and get a lot else besides. But thank you very much, Brad, for that. That was wonderful.
Yes, pleasure. Thank you very much, guys.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.